Born in Calcutta shortly before Indian independence, Mihir Bose still feels enormous gratitude towards Mr. Crombie of the UK's Home Office, who confirmed his permanent residence rights in 1975. After studying in Britain, Mihir had dreamed of making a life and career there. Now he could pursue it. Welcome to Afterwords. I'm Sarah Sands, an author and former newspaper editor and former colleague of Mihir Bose, author and award-winning journalist, who's the subject of today's podcast. Mihir was the BBC's first sports editor, first non-white editor, and the first journalist in the UK to specialise in covering the business of sport. His book, Thank You, Mr. Crombie, takes us back to Britain in the 1960s, a time when Indian food was shunned before it was adopted, of course, as a national dish. Landladies wouldn't rent him a room and he suffered several assaults, fearing for his life. Reflecting on migration, race and British society, the book looks at how far the country has come, but how it should also address the shameful aspects of its past. In today's episode, we'll hear Mihir speak about his arrival in Britain and how it differed from the world he left behind in India, how his life has changed over the 50 years that he's been living here, as well as his views on the future of Britain. I want to start by saying I love this book. I love it for the sweep of history and the perspectives on both India and Britain, mostly because of the really lovable personality of Mihir Bose at the centre. Good-natured, resourceful, resilient in the face of odds, and a remarkable journalist.
Thank you.
First, could you tell us a bit about growing up in Mumbai and the reason you wanted to come to the UK? Because you were the sort of opposite of an economic migrant. You left quite a comfortable life to come here to be a journalist, didn't you?
I was educated in a Jesuit school, and we were brought up in the idea that Britain was the best. Though India had got independence, we were very proud of being free Indians. We wanted validation from the British. At an early age, about the age of 14, I discovered this library of the British Deputy High Commissioner, which was just opposite our flat. We lived in the centre of Bombay. And I had all these wonderful British papers to read. They were printed on such fine paper, you felt you could not only read them, but actually eat them, you know. And I would read this wonderful writing, and I wanted to be like that. And somehow I just wanted to be a writer. When I was very young, I copied an article from the Times of India Colour Supplement and pasted it in one of my books and put my name on it. And my cousin said, oh, this is plagiarism. You can't do that. So I always wanted to have my name in the headlines, you know. And of course, later on, even my photograph appeared in the paper. Well, that might have put people off. I don't know. But, you know, I did manage to bluff many people in higher reaches of journalism, including you, Sarah, to believe that I could write.
Well, you were very good at taking opportunities, but of course it was your talent that got you through. And it's very interesting that you talk about the library and the body of British work, because there is literary references throughout this book. And one thing you talk about when the British left India in 1947 was you were a baby, but what that legacy meant. And you I think you quote Macmillan saying, oh, the British left institutions, and you're doubtful about that. But you do say they left some culture, which then India adopted very much for its own, but not, for instance, classical music. So it's very interesting the way you saw Britain and its legacy. And then we'll come to when you arrived in Britain and perhaps the difference.
The point about the British was that they have this marvellous culture. They are very inventive people, you know, and yet the British somehow, they don't seem to realise how much foreigners value that culture. They seem surprised. They constantly told me, how did you know this? And, you know, I read it in my books, you know, people talked about it. And the British don't value their own culture. They value a certain kind of history, you know, at times. And I feel now this love for imperial history is growing, which is less of a history to value. More is the British inventiveness to value. And what we wanted was validation from the British. And to give you an example of that, in the middle of Bombay, or as it was called when I was growing up, is a big park called Shivaji Park, where a lot of sport is played, particularly cricket. And it has produced some of the greatest cricketers in the world. And the Times of India sports editor said Shivaji Park is the Putsi of Mumbai, Putsi being the place in Yorkshire where Len Hutton, the first professional to captain England, a great cricketer, was born. And we felt that we had arrived by calling it the Putsi of Mumbai. But imagine if the Yorkshire Post were to say Putsi is the Shivaji Park of Yorkshire, the anti-woke warriors would be up in arms. Actually, Putsi only produced one cricketer. Shivaji Park produced an entire team. What I'm saying is we wanted this validation, and the British seem to be, they don't, I mean, you talked about orchestra. The British, while they were in India, never started an orchestra. The orchestra started about 40 years after the British had left. And why they didn't want to popularize British music, Western music, I could never understand it. Whereas the Japanese have taken to it, the Koreans have produced some great Western musicians. I think there is lack of pride. I think the British invent things for themselves and they're surprised when the foreigners take to it.
It's a really interesting insight, and it brings me on to another interesting thing you talk about, which is integration, that there are these great demands for people when they come here, they should integrate. You did make the point that the British didn't really integrate much within India. And there's a moving anecdote you tell about, I think, when the British left and your father had bought these Savile Row type suits, you know, thinking that this would continue, but in a way that, you know, once they're gone, they'd gone. They very much kept themselves to themselves. There wasn't the, as you would get with the Romans, you know, that the sort of intermarrying and the sense of a reciprocal culture.
Yes, and that is perhaps the most surprising thing about British rule. The British conquered India. They brought many ideas. Some of them survived, parliamentary democracy and so on, though they introduced it in a curious fashion. But nevertheless, they brought these ideas. But they didn't want to mix with the Indians. They kept within their own communities. And Malcolm Muggeridge has, and Alan Ross, both of whom lived in India. Alan Ross came from what may be called a British Indian family. And he said, we didn't know any Indians. The British met the Indians at the official level. And you talk about intermarriage, it's very interesting. When you conquer another country, when kings conquer or rulers conquer other countries, what they tend to do, and this is a historical pattern, is the conquering king marries a daughter of the conquered king. Alexander did this, and the Mughals who conquered India did this all the time. But no member of the royal family ever married the daughter of an Indian royal family. They paid polo and things like that. But that is all they did. You know, this sort of mixing at that social level was something the British found difficult, particularly with the Indians. And you know, that in a way did not develop the bonds that you would have expected 200 years or even longer association with India that the British had.
And that also affected you when you came to the UK, because your mother had read Walter Scott. You talked about Agatha Christie, which I think you used a quote talking to one of the landladies trying to get it to bedsit, and this sort of peculiar thing of suddenly not feeling welcome, or you were confused by the responses that you had.
Yes, I thought I knew England and I'd read so much about England that, you know, people would say, oh, yes, you know this. Oh, that's very interesting and so on. And the landladies, and this is 1969, soon after Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech and so on. And I was made aware of my colour in a way that I hadn't been aware of before. I was then a student, accountancy student in London. I'd been told by my partner at the accountancy firm, you get a student edition of the Times. And I would ring up from the advert saying, you know, bedsit available or a flatlet available. And they would say on the phone, yes, of course, come round, you know. It's, and the moment I arrived, they say, it's just gone. And after a time, I thought, hang on, there's something wrong here. So on the phone, I told one landlady, after she said, come around, listen, I'm from India. And there was a pause and she said, oh, my husband wouldn't like an Indian in the house. And I realized then that having a brown skin and coming from India was not an advantage. And then later on, I'd gone out on a couple of occasions with a young lady who I really thought we could have a relationship. And she said, no, we can't have a relationship because you can't give me white babies. And the irony of that story was that she made that observation while we were walking near the Lord's cricket ground. And one of my fantasies was that I would play for Oxford in a varsity match, go into bat, and the scoreboard would read 0 runs for 4 wickets. And then I would hit a 6 over the pavilion, which hasn't been done for 150 years. and this blonde in the grandstand would absolutely swoon with pleasure and fall in love with me. So, you know, suddenly I found that that wasn't quite how it worked out. Not that I've ever hit a six or ever played cricket at Lord's. I've reported it, but not played cricket at Lord's.
And there's sort of ignorant or the sort of casual, hurtful racism, and then there's violent racism, which was the rise you talk about of the skinheads. And there was one time where I think a skinhead had used the P word about you, but then it asked you about what you thought about Enoch Powell, and you sort of muse on this and say that, oh, the response you gave, I think, was that he was a very fine scholar of classical Greek, was your what you thought of Enoch Powell. But then you do say, I would like to have asked him if he realised the effect that his words had, that while he was speaking in this, that almost you would understand, you know, this sort of intellectual world, the real world effect that his words had.
Yes, I mean, the chap who asked me was a young boy of about 10, and, you know, and he was a bit surprised by my answer. And later on, what had happened, one of the magazines I worked for, I got Enoch Powell to review a book, and he did a very good review. And I sort of look back and think that I should really have asked for an interview and asked him how he felt about it, because the boy was very surprised when I said, oh, Enoch Powell is a great Greek scholar. And you see, I've tried hard to not play what people call the race card. Yes, these things have happened, but then this country has also opened up great many opportunities for me in the way that the land of my birth, where, of course, I had a great, very cushy life, but I got a job through sheer nepotism. But here, this country has opened up opportunities. Otherwise, I wouldn't have become a journalist. But if you like, there's a sort of conflict, a duality in the way the country operates. And I suppose all countries have a certain duality.
Tell me about those first sort of chances of setting out in journalism, whether you think that it could still happen that way today.
What happened was I had qualified as a chartered accountant. My father said there's no money in journalism. So I thought if there's no money in journalism, at least I'll earn my living as an accountant. And it was the summer of 1974. LBC had just started. Commercial radio had just started, Capital Radio and LBC. And with the cricket season starting, I rang up a sports editor. And basically, I bluffed. I said, listen, I know all about cricket. The Indian cricket team is coming. They're at the moment the best cricket team in the world. If you want cricket coverage, you really couldn't get somebody better. And he accepted and believed me. And he sent me to cover a cricket match. India were playing Hampshire. And as you know, Sarah, in journalism, to a certain extent, if you deliver the goods, nobody says, show me your certificate. Show me where you've qualified. You know, it's about what you produce. I mean, somehow it worked. And this is where I think the openness of Britain, the fact that you can ring people at the highest authority, you can write to them and they will respond, which is great contrast to India. In India, there's a word they use called chamcha, which means spoon. But basically what it means is sycophants who surround important people. So if you were in India, you would have chamchas around you, Sarah. One couldn't just ring you and contact you. And these sycophants would make sure that they were catered for, perhaps bribed, before, you know, access was made available to you. That shows that this country can open up in ways that people don't appreciate. And of course, what helped was that, particularly in terms of sport, as I was starting, commercialism was coming into sport, money was coming into sport, and because I had an accountancy qualification, I could read the accounts, which most of my fellow sports journalists were not interested in, and you know, they thought it was a waste of time, that shouldn't be reported on the sports pages. So I could tell editors, listen, I can provide you something that you can't get, you know, I can tell you how business is coming in. And I remember David Welsh, the sports editor of the Daily Telegraph. And I said, you know, you have men and women in shorts playing sport, but you have people in trousers who decide and determine how those games are played. And therefore, we must report on that. And unfortunately, I was able to convince them that that is worth reporting.
That crossover of city and sport did mean that you had really sort of created a genre. And it also meant some enormous scoops. You talk about both being excited and fearful, that moment when your story's out and no one's quite following it yet and the lawyers are on your back and so on, that it can be a lonely path, investigative journalism. And I think someone does say to you at one point, don't start looking for those stories, just know business people and the stories will come. And you talk about the Friday night drop, you know, when the just stories are given to you. But you went and found them at great patience and some cost. Can you just tell me about that spirit of investigative journalism.
I came into journalism in 1974 when the Watergate crisis had taken place and Bernstein and Woodward had removed a precedent in effect by their scoops and Watergate. To me, that was a role model. You know, that is what you should do. Talk to people. And what I've found, Sarah, is when you talk to people, not the people who are actually in charge, but their advisors, if you talk to the right advisors, they're often willing to talk to you. The accountants, the lawyers, particularly if they feel their clients haven't been well served. They will give you stories. And then the question is, of course, persuading editors like you and the lawyers how that can be done. And I was fortunate in getting documents and things like that and tapping the person at the right time and say, yes, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, or this is happening.
And it was always something very admirable about you that although you're very likable and very sociable, you put journalism first because it's quite easy in the areas you're working in, sport and sometimes city, that the relationships can come first. And actually, that's something I always really appreciated about you was that the journalism came first. And I think that's something that young journalists should really respect about you.
Yeah, I think I tell young journalists, you know, the editor will say, what is it that you bring different to the story? And you've got to give something. And I was always faced by this question. Why should we hire you? We've got enough journalists already. What are you bringing different? So if you like, my path into journalism was I was giving something extra. At least that's what I said. I was giving something extra. And of course, it was for the editors to hopefully accept that I was bringing something extra. And if you go down that route, you have to go down the full route. And of course, you are in danger of having a hostile reception of people saying, I won't talk to you and things like that. But you've got to take that in your stride. Otherwise, you won't get the story. And I've always wanted to get the great story. I'm not saying I've ever done a great, really, nothing obviously comparable to Watergate, but that doesn't happen to very many journalists. And also in my early days on the Sunday Times, they had the investigative journalists who used to spend weeks and months doing a story. And that was a model that I looked on because also to a certain extent, one thing about my journalism, it has covered a period, particularly in sports journalism, where sports writers were essayists. They went to a football match or a cricket match and they wrote a lovely essay full of wonderful words. And that is what they wanted to write.
And if I can just talk to you a bit about identity, which comes up in this book, identity that for you has evolved. There's a particularly moving chapter when you talk about your father and that understanding what it meant to him, as it were, to lose you, that you came over here. And that a time when he was ill, that you also, it was a time when you were very professionally busy. So you felt that there was an unfinished quality to your relationship. So you go back in a very Indian, Hindu way, you follow a ceremonial trip to pay tribute to your father. And could you just talk about that a little bit? Because that must be something that people feel about a kind of exile from their family and homeland sometimes.
When I decided finally to come back to this country to become a writer, I know I upset my father. You know, I'm the only son. He expected me to live in India, get settled, as he kept putting it, which meant get married, you know, and have a family and so on. And of course, when he was dying, I was far too busy with my journalism here. I was then more of a financial journalist, worried about Nigel Lawson's budget rather than going back to India and being with him. And I didn't get the opportunity to tell him as he lay dying that how much I loved him. I never said that. And that still pains me because I think about it and I think, you know, how much he must have felt that I was so far away. And I think that is the price of being an immigrant that you pay, the price of exile. And the Hindu ceremony that I finally took part in going to Benares and on the banks of the Ganges, you give moldy rice in the name of your father and your other ancestors. And this idea that the Hindu's idea of heaven is a bit different to the Christian one, that somewhere up in Mount Kailash, they're still there and they need to be fed and you're giving them food so that, you know, you're remembering them. And I did all that. And to a certain extent in doing that, I felt I hadn't made up for the fact that I hurt my father. Nothing could make up for the fact, but at least I recognized the fact that I had not completely forgotten my Hindu roots. And one of the things about growing up in even a post-colonial society is that what colonialism does is to make the people who were colonized feel that they needed to be approved and accepted by the colonizers. And in my case, though I knew Indian languages, I never felt Indian languages were good enough and equivalent to European languages. And only my wife, Caroline, who's English, said, you know, but you know several Indian languages. Why don't you say you know them? I always used to say I only know English. That sense of being what I am, my origins, and yet at the same time being part of another culture has grown in me in the last few years, that, you know, I can be part of two cultures and there need not be a divide. I mean, you know, obviously I feel more comfortable living in this country and this culture and being part of this culture, but I also have another element to me which probably can add to what I have here.
And that's very interesting because you talk also in terms, not just personally, but in terms of the country should be able to embrace a bit more complexity about its own role too, that it is too binary. And you talked at the start about this sense of pride in imperial history, slight lack of confidence in cultural history, but also that the European or UK version of what happened in India does not entirely tally, of course, with the experience of India. And we're seeing perhaps quite a lot more examination in books from Satna Sagira to Michelle Hussain and so on of just what partition meant to them. But do you feel that there's a time where there is a little bit more understanding that it's not so UK-centric or European-centric of events? Or do you think we're still not quite able to be more complex about what happened and or some of the shameful aspects of the past?
Yeah, I think it's growing. But I think what has happened is because history, as we know it, has been shaped by the Europeans because of their great dominance of the world, which was quite unique for about 400 years. I think when you mention other aspects of history, and if it is something that is uncomfortable, the feeling grows we have to apologize for it. What I say is not you don't have to apologize for it. You've got to admit that it happened, acknowledge it happened. You can't be held personally responsible for what happened 200 years ago. That is absurd. But you shouldn't try and say, oh, no, it wasn't quite like that, or it wasn't quite like that. We are faced, I think, Sarah, with what may be called the problem of the three A's: acknowledge, apologize, and applaud. If you say that imperialism was all glorious, then what you're really saying to the present generation is you've got to applaud it. No, you don't have to applaud it, but you've got to acknowledge it, nor do you have to apologize for it. I mean, my ancestors were, Jamindar's landlord, in what is now Bangladesh, we were a Hindu minority, lording it over the Muslims. When I went there to the village where we were supposed to own the village, it's all gone now as a result of partition, and they treated us very well, my wife and I, but they also told us that my Hindu ancestors had behaved very badly, and you know, they were very hostile and not at all kind and gentle to the Muslims. And I accept that they must have been, you know, I acknowledge that, but I don't feel I have to apologize for that. And I think this is where we have this problem. We feel, a lot of people in this country feel, if you acknowledging but some imperial thing which looks absolutely awful now, but you're immediately having to apologize. No, apology is not necessary, but acknowledgement is.
That's interesting. So a figure such as Churchill, you know, who's the one that causes a lot of trouble, because obviously total war hero here, but you come up with very evidenced reports of what he'd said, particularly about the Hindus and so on. And so it's that sense that people can be heroes and have feet of clay, you know, that, and that's quite a almost a sort of novelistic thing that you're able to understand, but still is hard for people, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Churchill was a great man. There was no question. His leadership during the war was absolutely brilliant and what he did. But he did also not like the Hindus, which is well documented. And if you mention that, people say, oh, well, you know, Churchill said many things, or he must have said it when he was drunk and so on. No, you can't sort of dismiss it that way. You've got to accept what Churchill said and yet also acknowledge that Churchill wasn't a monster or anything like that. Churchill had great many qualities which you can value and even venerate, but he wasn't a saint, you know. And this is where I think this country has not really reconciled to the fact that as a result of the Second World War, it lost its empire and lost its position as the number one country in the world. And the war is remembered in a very sort of edited version of, you know, the Battle of Britain and so on. The war was very complicated, affected by lots of things and even today, to a certain extent, we are still living in the after effects of the Second World War. And the echoes, you know. And I think this country hasn't reconciled to that. And this country should say, right, we were a great country, we did many things, but some good, some bad. And we have now in a new position where we can still do a lot of things because we are still a very inventive, creative people. For instance, this country created sport. And, you know, the playwrights, the novelists, the poets and so on. I mean, this country's role, this small island's role in creating such an amazing wealth of intellectual talent, why that is not appreciated, I can never understand.
Perhaps it's your grounding in Shakespeare that gives you this more complex view. Thank you very much indeed, Mihir. And I'm going to ask you one last question, which I think all guests are asked on this show, which is about one source or text, whether it's a film, a book, or otherwise, that influenced this book.
Funnily enough, the film that really moved me, and the one that, when I was young, my friends saw it millions of times, was Guns of Navarone. And Guns of Navarone has a scene where David Niven tells Gregory Peck, who's fallen in love with this Greek who turns out to be a spy for the Germans, that he has to kill her, and he doesn't want to. And Niven then says, do it for England. And a friend of mine and I, Eddie, we used to play cricket, and then we would meet in the middle while we were batting and say, do it for England. And to me, that do it for England was always a word that echoed. And I wanted to find out this England. What was it like to do it for England? And I always thought that everybody in England looked like David Niven, you see. So and every woman looked like Susan Hampshire. Until I met you, I didn't find another one who looked like Susan Hampshire.
Well, very good to end on cricket and heroism.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you.
To follow more, follow Hearst at Hearst Publishers, Mihir at Mihir Bose, and I'm on Sarah Sands Norfolk. And to get news on the latest Hearst book, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Sarah Sands. Thank you for listening.